Welcome to the Warriors of Grace podcast, hosted by Dave Jenkins. Warriors of Grace is about helping men from generation to generation become gospel men in private, in the home, in the church, and in public through the Word of God. Now for today's episode, let's join our host, Dave Jenkins.
Welcome back to the Warriors of Grace podcast. My name is Dave, and I'm the host for this podcast. And today we continue our study through 1 Timothy, looking today at 1 Timothy 5, 9 through 16, and pure and unadulterated religion. 1 Timothy 5, 9 through 16 says this: "Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband, and having a reputation for good works. As she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work, but refuse to enroll younger widows, for when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry, and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but also gossip and busybodies, saying what they should not. So I'd have younger widows marry, bear children, and manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander, for some have already strayed after Satan. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened, so that it may care for those who are truly widows." We need to ask the question at the start of our study today, and the question is this: what is the essence of true religion? The Bible gives one answer to this question, or at least it expresses the same answer in several ways, as we're about to see. The prophet Micah said that the Lord requires you to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God in Micah 6:8. Jesus said the two greatest commandments are to love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul, and your neighbor as yourself. The apostle James said something a little different, or maybe he said the same thing and made it more specific, in James 1:27, which says, "Religion that is pure and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unstained from the world." Caring for women who are alone in the world is one of the best ways to honor God and love our neighbor. It is Christianity at its finest, and taking care of widows is pure, unadulterated religion. In fact, if looking after orphans and widows in their distress is the very essence of Christianity, this explains why Paul's letter to Timothy contains such extensive teaching about widows. In fact, the apostle, as we saw last time, has already explained what makes a true widow and has commended true widows to the ministry of prayer. He also commanded Christians to provide for their own relatives. And in the verses to follow, Paul explains how the church should treat widows left to its care. Apparently, the church was systematic about doing this because there's a list of widows, verse 9 says. In fact, the Ephesians were still getting themselves organized as a newly organized, planted church. But first things first, the church was already maintaining a list of widows. Well, what was this list for, we need to ask? It was to make sure that widows receive their daily bread. Widows are registered so they can be helped. And this is clear from the end of the passage, where the Holy Spirit instructs the church to care for those who are really widows in verse 16. And so the model for this was the first church in Jerusalem, which had organized a daily distribution of food from the very beginning. A church needs to keep track of who its widows are, where they live, and what they need. But there's another reason for a list of widows. These women seem to have some special ministry in the church. Calvin is probably closest to the mark when he argued that the role of widows was both for support and for service. And a good example of the position of widows in the early church comes from the ministry of Dorcas in the city of Joppa. And Dorcas was exactly the kind of woman Paul would go on to describe for Timothy, a woman who is full of good works and acts of charity, Acts 9:36 says. And when she died, the whole community mourned. And in their grief, they sent for Peter. And when they arrived, Acts 9:39 says, all the widows stood beside him weeping and showing tunics and other garments that Dorcas made while she was with them. And after Peter miraculously brought Dorcas back to life, he called the saints widows and presented her alive, Acts 9:41 says. It's clear from this account that the widows had a distinctive identity within the early Christian church. There were large numbers of them, and by the 3rd century, they formed an official order in the church. And these widows gave themselves to prayer, they nursed the sick, they cared for the orphans, they visited Christians in prison, they evangelized pagan women, and they taught female converts in preparation for their baptism. And by the Middle Ages, few, if any, of the churches followed the guidelines given in 1 Timothy 5. And this was a sort of an amazement to Calvin, who had to admit when it came to widows, even his church in Geneva was not organized along biblical lines. Doubtless, one reason why the contemporary church is so confused about the role of women is that this pattern for women's ministry has largely been neglected or even forgotten altogether. And the main reason for thinking that these widows must have been active in some form of Christian ministry is the way they're described in 1 Timothy 5:9 through 10. Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband, and having a reputation for good works. If she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work. These qualifications would seem overly strict if a widow had to meet all of them or before she could get any help from the church. In particular, it seems unlikely that Paul would set a seemingly arbitrary age as a prerequisite for destitute women to receive benevolence. And yet, possibly the qualification he gives are intended to serve as loose guidelines rather than strict requirements. But you see, these requirements would make better sense as qualifications for women to serve in some form of ministry in the church. And now 3 requirements are given in our text. First, maturity or seniority. Verse 9 says, let a woman be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age. And so the age Paul gives may well come as a surprise to a postmodern culture with its preoccupation with youth. In the ancient world, however, 60 was sometimes viewed as the age at which a person reached full maturity. In Plato's Ideal Republic, for example, 60 was the minimum age for priests and priestesses. And so women under the age of 60 could work to support themselves or else remarry. However, the Bible assumes that a widow in her 60s or 70s is unlikely to marry. Excuse me. And the second requirement to be enrolled as a widow is fidelity. Only a widow who has been the wife of one husband, 1 Timothy 5:9, is eligible for this list. And so the expression used here is the same one used to earlier to describe elders and deacons. The widow is to be a one-man woman. Part of what prepared her for faithful ministry was a faithful marriage. And the third requirement is charity. She must have a reputation for good works, verse 10, which Paul proceeds to list in logical order. He begins with the bringing up of children because raising a family is the most important work many Christian women are given to do. But you see, the good work of bringing up children is not limited to a woman's own children. There were a great many orphans in the ancient world, as there are today. A godly woman has pity for all God's children, and as she has the opportunity, she shows them God's loving care. Maternity leads to hospitality. Once a woman gets her house in order, she is ready to welcome strangers, which has always been a cardinal Christian virtue. According to Christendom, the hospitality here spoken of is not merely a friendly reception, but one given with zeal and with readiness and going about it as if one were receiving Christ himself. Hospitality is especially important in the ancient world where travel was inhospitable and even dangerous. And caring for strangers reflect God's hospitable grace, encouraged interaction between the Christian communities, and facilitated the movements of traveling Christian preachers and thus the spread of the gospel. And the first thing a good hostess did for her guests in the ancient world was to remove their sandals and wash their dusty feet. And hence Paul's requirement that in order to be enrolled, a widow must have wash the feet of the saints, verse 10. And the gesture of humility was usually performed by slaves, but a widow known for good deeds would do it herself. Such a woman is willing to perform humble, even menial tasks for our brothers and sisters in Christ. Now, foot washing is a reminder that the godly widow patterns her life after the example of Jesus Christ. From the night after he was betrayed, Jesus rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments and, taking a towel, tied it around his waist. And then he poured it into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him, John 13:4-5 tells us. Like a common servant, Jesus bathed the grubby feet of his disciples. And the disciples could hardly believe it. At first, Peter wouldn't even stand for it. Why was their master acting like a servant? How could the Lord of glory take the place of a slave? And the answer is that Jesus was showing the disciple how much he loved them. He had not come into the world to be served, but to serve. And he gave his life as a ransom, Matthew 20:28 says. And so washing his disciples' feet was a preview of the future event when Jesus would pour out his lifeblood for their sins on the cross. And whenever a Christian washes the feet of the saints, performs some other act of a humble act or ministry, he follows the example of Jesus, who says this in John 13:14-17. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Now, the widow who belonged on the church's official list is the kind of woman who has received the blessing of Jesus by following his example of loving service. And finally, verse 10 says, a true widow has cared for the afflicted and has devoted herself to every good work. You see, this list isn't meant to be exhaustive. A godly woman is godly in every way. She nurses the sick back to health, gives food to the hungry, comforts the victim of persecution, and so on and so forth. Charity begins at the home and then it spreads around to the community. And so one of the reasons the church has always been the leader in mercy ministry is that Christian people, especially Christian women, have devoted themselves to all forms of godly and good deeds for the glory of God. You see, Christians were the first to rescue abandoned babies, the first to set up schools for orphans, the first to develop nursing care, and the first to establish homes for the elderly, and so on and so forth. You see, younger women ought to devote themselves to all kind of good deeds. They should host Bible clubs for the children in their neighborhoods. They should care for pregnant teenagers. They form friendships with people dying of AIDS. They tutor inner city children. They open their home to guests. They pray for the work of the church. They work in hospitals, the schools, even on the streets of the city to show the love of Christ, and on and on. And yet not every woman made Paul's list. Some were not eligible to serve in public ministry or even to receive financial support. Christian charity, to be clear, is not entitlement, not even for Christian widows. You see, some did not qualify for help because they had not been faithful to their husbands or active in good works, or they were too young. Verse 11 says, but refused to enroll younger widows. And what was Paul's reasoning here for this? First, younger widows are less likely to keep their promise. Verse 11 through 12 says, from their passions draw them away from Christ. They desire to marry and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. As difficult as these verses are, it's important to realize that Paul was not opposed to marriage or even sex. In the English language, passion and desire almost make it sound as if wanting to get married or shared sexual intercourse is immoral. But you see, the term simply refers to a woman's natural sexual desire, which is given by God, and its proper fulfillment is in marital intercourse between a man and a woman in covenant with God in marriage for life. And nor is Paul opposed to remarriage. People in their ancient world commonly believed that it was disloyal for widows to remarry. But this is not the biblical view, since verse 14 explicitly gives permission to younger widows to remarry. And if Paul is not opposed to marriage in and of itself, then what is he opposed to? The word faith leads some scholars to think that these women have left Christianity altogether. For support, they point to Paul's instructions in 1 Corinthians 7:39, which says a wife is bound to her husband for as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. While possibly in their sexual desires, some of the young widows in Ephesus were marrying pagans and thus abandoning the Christian faith. It is perhaps more likely, however, that the faith is used here in the sense of pledge or even vow. And this may be another clue that these widows has a special ministry in the church, or at least for spiritual reasons, they vow to remain single. And now women who enter this order of widows made a covenant commitment before God to remain unmarried. They dedicated themselves to Christ almost as if they were married to him. And the oath these women took was completely voluntary, but once it was made, it needed to be kept. And if a young widow took a vow of celibacy and then later proceeded to remarry, she would have to break her commitment to the church, virtually breaking off an engagement to Christ himself. In any case, the warning that Paul gives applies more generally to all single Christians and not just to widows. You see, it's possible for the desire to get married to outweigh someone's desire to serve Christ. Sometimes single Christians are so determined to get married that not even their relationship to Christ can stand in the way. They put their lives on hold until God provides a spouse. Or they use poor judgment about dating relationships, even courting unbelievers. Or they rush off and get engaged without noticing all the warning signs that the person they want to marry is unsuitable. There were young widows like that in the early church too, and they brought judgment on themselves. And the reason they incurred condemnation was not that they had a sexual impulse or even that they remarried, but that they broke their promise to Christ. And it would have been better for them not to make a vow at all than one that they were unable to keep. And Paul's warning also shows one inherent liability in the way that the order of nuns are established in the Roman Catholic Church. Through the centuries, the Catholic Church gradually lowered the age from 60 until finally even teenagers could take a vow of celibacy. And they also allow women who had never married to become nuns. But you see, the Bible restricts such a vow to widows of at least 60 because the younger women are less likely to be able to keep the promise. And so whether they're young or old, married or single, women who aspire to godliness should dedicate themselves to the deeds of mercy and contentment in the present time, trusting in Christ alone. And the other danger of putting young widows in the church roles is that they're likely to waste their time. Verse 13 tells us, besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but also gossip and busybodies, saying what they should not. These women were like social butterflies. They were involved in the gossip and the life of the church, and since the church was paying their rent, they were free to go wherever they wanted and do whatever they wanted with their friends. And this may even mean they were going from church to church, about from house to house, and so on and so forth. And here the Bible warns against the sin that people often fall into when they have nothing better to do, and that's laziness, what the Bible calls idleness. It's also known as sloth, which is one of the traditional seven deadly sins. Idleness is unwillingness to make much of an effort, like a three-toed sloth hanging upside down all day from a tree, fast asleep. It's an easy habit to fall into when someone else is paying your bills, which is why Paul did not want Timothy to put young widows on the roll of pay. Human beings were created for work. Exodus 20, verse 9 says, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. This does not mean that every Christian has to work at a paying job, but every Christian must work. People who depend on one form of public assistance or another need to find something productive to do with their time, either at home or even in the community. If nothing else, there is always plenty of volunteer work to do at church. Idleness usually leads to other sins, in this case, gossip. And the women Paul was warning Timothy about were not only idlers, but verse 13 says, but also gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. The church in Thessalonica must have had a similar problem, since Paul had heard that some of them were idle too. They were not busy at work, he said, but busybodies, in 2 Thessalonians 3:11. And in Ephesus, as such women made their way from house to house, they heard all kinds of interesting news, none of which at all should have been repeated, but they repeated it anyway. And what were these young widows saying? Well, some of them have been spreading false theology, which is a major problem in Ephesus. Others may have been trying to help people who were in major trouble, only they did not know how to keep a confidence. And still others may have been spreading malicious rumors. Gossip in all its varieties is a common problem in the church, perhaps especially among Christian women. Through the wonders of the telephone, the internet, and other forms of communication technology, one can be a busybody from the privacy of one's own home or even one's automobile. All it takes is a finger to type on the keyboard or a chin to prop the cell phone on one's shoulder. It's good for Christians to stay in close touch with one another, but not just to have something juicy to talk about. Instead, intimate conversations should be directed towards encouraging the weak, helping the needy, saving the lost souls, and setting an agenda for prayer. Christian friendships should be spiritual as well as social. And many people tend to overlook idleness and gossip, but they're serious sins. Consider how destructive they are. Idleness destroys one's property, Proverbs 6, 9 through 11 says, "How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed man." Idleness also destroys the soul. It weakens every aspect of spiritual life. It's one of the leading contributors of depression. An idle person loses their zeal for God for life itself. And gossip is equally destructive. It destroys others, especially their relationship with others. Proverbs 16:28 says, "A whisperer separates close friends." Whispering also fuels a controversy. You see, gossip has contributed to nearly every conflict and division in the history of the church. And it's because these sins are so destructive that Paul proposes a solution in verse 14. "So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their household, and give the adversary no occasion for slander." And so the word Paul uses and expresses his intentions here is the same word of authority that he uses in 1 Timothy 2:12 and elsewhere. This is not merely Paul's personal advice. This is an apostolic command. That is not to say that each and every single woman must find a husband, which of course is up to the providence of God. As a general rule, it's good for young widows to devote themselves to the care of their families and even to remarry. And what Paul says about remarriage in 1 Timothy 5 is fully consistent with what he says about singleness in 1 Corinthians 7, 7 through 9, which says, "I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to be aflame with passion." And notice that widows are specifically mentioned as women who might be better off getting married. The single life is a good life, especially when it's devoted to fruitful Christian service. Indeed, singleness is Paul's personal preference for those who are so gifted. But there are many reasons to get married, along with the danger of sexual temptation. Remarriage is a good solution to the problems Paul was worried about in Ephesus. And to begin with, running a household is a terrific remedy for idleness. Once you get married and you start having children, you'll probably be so busy, you won't have much time to be idle, as any mother can testify to. You will have to work of your own without worrying about somebody else's business. But what happens if these instructions are ignored? Well, the passage ends in verse 14 with Paul wanting to give the adversary no occasion for slander. And the word adversary may refer to unbelievers. And so if the young widows of the church do not behave themselves, especially if they fall into sexual sin, the public reputation of the church will be damaged. An even greater adversary, however, is mentioned in the very next verse, verse 15. "For some have already strayed after Satan." God's old enemy, Satan, was lurking in the shadows of the apostolic church. He enticed some widows to follow him, and this was the result of false teaching, since the false teachers were forbidding people to marry. Well, in any case, Satan would like nothing better than to destroy the Christian home. The reference to Satan is a reminder that mothers at home with their children are engaged in spiritual warfare, and their work is difficult, and of course, it's filled with temptations and frustrations. This is spiritual warfare. And when a Christian mother teaches her child a spiritual lesson, she does so in defiance of Satan. Even daily chores, if they're done in devotion to Christ, are small victories over the devil and his work. The Christian home is never just a home. It's a military outpost. This whole 1 Timothy is mainly intended to make sure that widows get the care that they need. And so after explaining that some widows do not need any help, Paul closes with a reminder that others need to be helped after all. 1 Timothy 5:16, if any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened, so that it may care for those who are really widows. Now, scholars are puzzled over why this instruction is given only to women and not to men. But here's the thing here. Whether women or men or involved or even both, the important thing is for Christians to provide for their relatives. The family is a first line of defense for the poor. Calvin says that before the church has to carry the burden, let the children do their duty. The early church seems to understood this principle well, for the chapel of the Villa Albulani in Rome contained the following inscription: to the good Regina, her daughter has erected this memorial. To the good Regina, her widowed mother, who was a widow for 60 years and never burdened the church after she was a wife of only one husband. She lived 80 years, 5 months, and 26 days. So the inscription shows how honorable it is for Christians to take care of their own relatives. And the second line of defense for the poor is the church. And one of the advantages of belonging to the Church of Jesus is always having family to provide for one's needs. And since the finances of the church are limited, it's necessary for Christians to care for their own poor. Then the church will have enough money to assist the truly destitute. And one place where widows really were in need was the city of Kyiv back in the 1990s after the collapse of communism. As the economy faltered, the streets began to fill with beggars. Poor women approached strangers and cried loudly for a few bucks to buy bread. And what happened to the widows of the church? One evangelical congregation took care of its widows by hosting banquets at which they served rich feasts of beef, mashed potatoes, vegetables, fruit, salad, and bread. This is what the church did in Kyiv. But what is being done for the elderly in your own church, especially for the widows? Do you know who they are? Do you know where they live? Do you know what they need? Such questions are important to answer, because looking after widows is of the very essence of Christianity. You see, I want to thank you for listening or watching this episode of the Warriors of Grace podcast. Until next time, may the Lord richly bless you and keep you.
Thank you for listening to the Warriors of Grace podcast. If you enjoyed the show today, please subscribe, leave a rating on the app, and share our episode with your friends and family. If you want to, you can follow us on Instagram at Servants of Grace, on Twitter at Servants of Grace, or search Servants of Grace on Facebook. You can also find our show on the front page of the website servantsofgrace.org.